MechCast, Wednesday, February 16th, 2011. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Hey, I guess it's time to get back into the regular swing of things, back from Macworld. We've had a couple special episodes. Been a little bit under the weather lately. You might still be able to hear some of the residuals of that, but I'm getting over things. I'm feeling better, and so it's time to get back into the news, the Mac news, and some tips and tricks and things that I have to bring to you today. Before we dive into that, though, I do want to take a quick moment, thank one of our show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, if you haven't checked out Notebook, I encourage you to just head over to the website. They have a free trial available over at circusponies.com. You can download the software. You can try it out. Fully functional. Check out all the features and things like that. And you can see if it's something that's going to fit into your workflow. But you know, I have to tell you, I've been using it for a couple years now, and I just keep finding uses for it. And one of the things I like about it is it's great if you need to, if you have a project or you have something you're working on and you need to collect separate bits of information from different areas to put into a project. And I thought the best way to kind of explain that is to give you an example. This isn't something I'm doing, but it just popped into my mind. Say you're redecorating a room, right, in your house, and you're going to have to put a bunch of stuff together. You're going to be doing research on the types of furniture and items and things that you want to do. Well, you might be collecting a series of web links or information from different web pages. You can use the web clippings to put that into your notebook. You might take photos or grab photos of samples of fabrics and things like that. You can drop those into your notebook. You probably will have lists of things to do. You can put together a to-do list on one page, all the places you need to go, all the things you need to collect. Throw together diagrams. If you want to do a rough layout of your room, you could do that right inside Notebook. And you could also then add in tabs and notes and flags for different pages and things that you're working on. And when you get down to actually buying the items and you're purchasing things either online or maybe at the store, you can scan in your receipts, generate PDFs, you can put those into the notebook as well, and you can keep that all organized. If you're doing a whole house, you could have separate sections for each room, or maybe just a section for the materials, and all that stuff then gets indexed in a bunch of different ways by a technology Notebook has called the Multidex. So you can go back through, you can find just all of the links that you have within a document. It doesn't matter what pages of your notebook those are on. Those will be in one little section in the Multidex, along with a bunch of other information. It is really cool stuff. They have a new iPad version available, so if you need to sync it over to your iPad, you can grab the iPad version, and the files transfer back and forth between the iPad and the Mac. And it's really great. So just check it out, circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So big news this week, Apple came out with subscriptions for all. They opened it up to all developers. I think a couple weeks ago, Apple made an announcement with The Daily, Rupert Murdoch. They came out with the first subscription, true subscription publication on the iPad. It's been free for a couple weeks, and they actually just extended it. That has led to rumors that maybe iOS 4.3 is going to have the updates to fully support subscriptions, and so The Daily is just waiting for Apple to release that update. That's pure speculation at this point, but definitely there are other publications that can now take up advantage of the subscription program. It did generate a little bit of controversy because of how it's sort of set up. So let me give you the details. So publishers can have in-app subscriptions, the ability to have a magazine or a newspaper, something like that, and you'd be able to buy the subscription in the app. They can also have subscriptions outside the app. So they can direct you to their website and you go to the website and sign up. The difference between the two methods is that in the case of purchasing in-app, Apple's going to get that 30% cut. It's the same 30-70 split that they've always done. If a publisher is able to drive you to the application and get you to subscribe from their website, sort of outside the application, and then take advantage of using the app to consume that subscription, I guess is how you might put it, then they get to keep 100% of the revenue. The controversy comes into play in that Apple has said if publishers offer subscriptions in their app, they have to allow you to subscribe in the app as well as outside the app. The publisher can't force you to go outside the app to do your subscriptions or to make your purchases, it sounds like. And that has some implications for some existing applications. And because of that, Apple has given developers until June 30th to comply. Now, you may remember a story from a couple weeks back with Sony. Sony had submitted their ebook reader and Apple had rejected it. And the reason given was that there was no ability to buy the books inside the app. You had to go outside the app, and Apple said that was a violation of their terms of service. Yet we had other applications like the Kindle app that allowed that sort of thing. So it seemed to be in conflict, but Apple's now saying, look, we've always had this policy. We've just never really enforced it, and now we're enforcing it, and that's what's kind of causing this kerfuffle. So we have to see what happens with the Kindle and other ebook style applications. Also up in the air are services like Hulu or Netflix. I don't know how that fits into this whole subscription thing. You know, I love having Netflix on my iPad. I bought my Netflix subscription way before they had a Netflix app, but does that mean that now Netflix has to give users the ability to sign up for Netflix within the Netflix app? Or is it maybe different because you have to have the subscription coming into it? It's really, really unclear. But the features of Apple's subscription program are that you will be able to review and manage your subscriptions all from the personal account page. They said that in the press release. I'm assuming that means the account page that's in iTunes, although I don't have a subscription now to check it, but I would assume that when you go into the iTunes store and you click on your account, there'll be some way to manage your reoccurring subscriptions or your subscriptions from in there, including doing things like canceling or automatically renewing your subscription. Now, if someone purchases a subscription from within the app, Apple's going to take that 30% cut. Publishers do have the option, and I really like this, to provide free access to existing subscribers who have purchased outside the application. As a matter of fact, a couple of publications, Elle and Popular Science, already updated their applications in the App Store to include the in-app subscription options, and they have an option if you were an existing subscriber to the print publications, the print versions of those publications, you can actually get the digital option now for free. And you can, I think, sign up and just activate that through the application. Now, another little item that is causing publishers to be a little bit upset is Apple does say in the terms that publishers can no longer provide links in their applications to external websites. So jumping out of, I would assume, the app into Safari. Now, I don't know if that means they can't have a Safari browser or WebKit browser embedded inside the application itself and send you to links that way. A bunch of the publications that I have now already do that. So I don't know if that's going to be disallowed. But you know, I think the concern is that linking outside would allow customers to purchase content outside the app or purchase subscriptions outside the application. As far as privacy goes, this was one of those sticking points when publishers were wanting to bring subscriptions to the iPad. They need to have certain amounts of information, or that information is typically valuable to them to give out to their advertisers in terms of who their customers are and stuff like that. When purchasing a subscription through the App Store, customers have to be given the option on whether or not they want to provide the publisher with their name, email address, or zip code when they subscribe. It sounds like they don't have to, and that's the base information that most publishers are going to want. Information, when you do allow it to be given out, needs to be used under the publisher's privacy policy. So you're not going to be governed by Apple's privacy policy. You're going to be governed by the publisher's privacy policy. And that has to be inside the app. It has to be there available for you to review inside the app. And publishers can request that you send them additional information, but again, it has to be an opt-in. So Apple is really kind of in control of any information that's gathered from inside the app. So far, reactions have been pretty mixed, although I would say mostly on the negative side from the publisher perspective and from the application developer perspective. We're still going to have to see how this all shakes out. From the consumer side of things, I'm really excited about this because I am hoping, hoping, and that's the key word, because I think a lot of publishers aren't going to take advantage of Apple's terms. Apple's kind of holding the iPad hostage as a platform for publishing your application. But let's assume the publishers jump in and they take advantage of this. I think this is great. I'm a subscriber to Wired. I've wanted to get the Wired version of Wired on my iPad, but at $4 an issue, it's just too expensive. Now, I think I pay about $20 a year US for my print subscription. Even if they wanted to double that, if they said, you know what, you pay $40 and we'll give you both the print version and the digital version, I might actually do that. I don't know. That might be a little bit too much, but I'd consider it because I'd like having the digital copy along with my print copy. So I'm hoping we're going to see more of that. We've, like I said, already seen a couple publishers jump on board. Google did counter this week with a service they're calling OnePass. Yahoo also has a new subscription service, and both of those services are more open. They're outside, and I have a feeling their terms are going to be more favorable for publishers. So we're going to have to see how this goes. If those outside services can take advantage of the web and give you like an HTML5 full web version that works with the Safari browser on the iPad, Apple might have some competition, and they might actually have to, you know, give in a little bit on their current subscription model restrictions. We'll have to see how this all shakes out, but it's going to get very, very interesting. I just hope that in the end, consumer demands and things like that are what went out. But, you know, Apple has a pretty, with the amount of market share they have with the iPad, they have a pretty strong position. So there's definitely going to be a fight on this stuff, I think. Couple of software updates were released this week. iWeb 3.0.3. That's right. I said Apple actually gave some love to iWeb. We know that with the last release of iLife Suite, iWeb was not updated. This is a minor release. It addresses a couple of issues. One being an issue when using the iSight movie widget on certain Macs. That apparently wasn't working. It's been fixed. It addresses an issue when publishing iWeb websites using FTP and improves compatibility with Mac OS 10. Another software update, Aperture 3.1.1. This was released to address overall stability and performance issues, fixes some compatibility with the iLife media browser, improves reliability when upgrading your existing Aperture libraries. That seems like something Apple's been struggling with Aperture for a while now. So be careful on your upgrades. Make sure that you back up before you upgrade Aperture. And then finally, addresses issues with publishing photos to MobileMe, Flickr, and Facebook. So a couple of those, if you have iLife or an Aperture user, you probably want to grab those. You can get them by running software update in the system preferences or by going to apple.com/support. And then for those of you who've been wondering about when Apple's going to update iWork 11, a little rumor came out this week. There was something posted on a Best Buy Mexico website. Best Buy's Mexican version, I guess, of their website showed that iWork 11 was going to be available supposedly this week on February 19th. I think that's on Saturday, which seems a little bit odd. Apple typically doesn't do software updates, update releases on the weekend. But it might be in the works. It's certainly due for an update. So if you've been waiting for a new version of iWork, you might not have to wait much longer. Another big update that might be along in less than a month, at least if you believe the rumors, is new MacBook Pros, possibly due out March, as early as March 1st, according to some of the rumors. What would be included in a new version of the MacBook Pro? Well, they're saying Apple is finally going to leverage that liquid metal technology that they invested in. So far, the only thing that Apple has done with liquid metal is the little SIM ejector clip. If you've had an iPhone and you got that special little tool for ejecting the SIM, that was created using the liquid metal technology. And one of the advantages of the liquid metal is that supposedly it can be kind of molded like plastic or used like plastic is in manufacturing. So doing stuff like injection molding cases. And I guess that's what they're going to do with this next model. If it does, in fact, use the liquid metal technology, they will injection mold a new unibody case, and the advantage would be that it would be up to 20% lighter. I think the liquid metal technology also allows for better transmission of radio signals, so I would assume we would get better Wi-Fi and Bluetooth signal reception with a new MacBook Pro if they do use this for the case technology. Reports are also saying that we can expect about 20% better battery life, so Apple's been able to squeeze better batteries in there. And the thought is that it would use Intel's new Sandy Bridge architecture technology for the processors, the next generation of processors from Intel, although those did have some issues, which might be why we've seen a little bit of a delay in the release of the next MacBook Pros. I guess that's been resolved. It was something to do with its support for serial ATA devices and the number of devices it could support. I guess in some cases, it used something called their Cougar Point chipset, and it had a design flaw where serial ATA transfers could degrade over time or slow down over time. So I guess it affected performance. That reportedly has been resolved, and it is assumed that Apple will be using that technology in the next generation of MacBook Pros. Big news is that the pricing might also be slightly lowered. Apple typically brings out new laptops in about the same price range, but we might see lower pricing so that Apple's a little bit more competitive. Also, I think a lot of the design cues and things that Apple's looking at, because the MacBook Air has been so popular, a lot of the reports are saying it's selling almost as quickly as the MacBook Pros are. It's really got a good uptake that we'll see things like SSD drives. And I even read some rumors that it might have a modular bay support, meaning that you could easily swap out your optical drive for another SSD or serial ATA drive or something like that. And Apple played around with that technology a while back. You know, the more recent MacBooks and things like that have been a little bit more closed, but back in the day, Apple used to have, if anybody remembers those MacBooks, or PowerBooks, what am I saying? The PowerBooks back in the day, where you could actually just pop out the optical drive and swap it in with another drive or a second battery. Remember those? So I'm assuming it'd be that similar type of technology, probably more inside the enclosure, though, you know, where you have to open up the back case and then be able to pop out or swap out the optical drive for an SSD or a serial ATA drive. And that would be pretty cool to see that in the next generation models. So if you've been considering a new MacBook Pro and the rumors turn out to be true, March should be the time frame when we'll get our eyes on those. So look forward to that. And I guess this show is going to be a big rumor show. Everybody's wondering what Apple's going to do next. We also saw this week a lot of speculation about the next generation iPhones, including multiple different kinds of models. Of course, the iPhone 5, everybody's expecting to come out in June. The latest rumors is that Apple might be considering a new larger 4-inch screen to compete with some of the other smartphones that are coming out, Android-based phones and BlackBerry phones that are using the larger 4-inch screens. That would mean that either the iPhone would have to get larger in terms of its form factor, or some sites are saying possibly Apple could wedge a screen into a phone the size of the current iPhone 4, but it would have to go edge to edge, and there's no other kind of phone on the market where you have an edge to edge screen. Typically, you need to have some sort of bezel to kind of hold it in the frame. So there would be a major redesign that would need to go on. There have been some sort of mock-ups surfacing online just to show what that looks like. And I'm not sure that it looks all that great. It looks interesting, but I think it would make more sense if they went with a larger form factor phone. But I don't think Apple's going to do that. I like the current size and shape of the iPhone 4. I think Apple is going to stick to that design. And I don't really see a need to go to a larger screen. But, you know, I've never had a larger screen phone. To me, the difference in size doesn't seem to really make that much of a difference. And Steve Jobs did say in the quarterly conference call that he kind of thinks about those kinds of things as the tweener style devices, somewhere between the portability of a phone and the sort of versatility of a tablet like the iPad. Near field communication support seems to be one of those things that lots of people are buzzing about. This would be the ability to use your iPhone as a payment system, for example. So say when you're checking out at the grocery store, you could just tap your iPhone and pay that way. It would also enable the ability to do things like maybe logging into a Mac. So you simply get your phone near your Mac, and if it had a receiver that could pick up on the near field communication, it could automatically log you into your device. And it's even gone further to say that the iPhone might become that thing that you carry around your home user folder on, and all of your data kind of carries with you. And when you walk up to a Mac or another system, it could log you in and access that data and information. That would be very interesting, and may rely also on some cloud-based functionality. But Deutsche Telekom did show a slide reportedly that was talking about their support for near-field communication on their network, and they showed an image of an iPhone. That led to a lot of the speculation that the iPhone is going to include near-field communication. I think that was just coincidental. I think they were just showing an image of a phone that they carry on their network, and it just happened to be an iPhone when they were talking about it. But did certainly start all the rumor sites in the internet a buzzing about what might be in the new iPhone 5. I certainly believe the rumors that the iPhone 5 will have a new, faster processor. The code name I had heard at one point was the A8, but everybody seems to be speculating now it's the A5, up from the current A4 that you find in the iPhone 4. The new processor would reportedly be based on the ARM Cortex A9 design, and probably would be dual core. A lot of the newer smartphones are coming out with dual core processors. I believe that as long as Apple can figure out any power issues related to running a dual core design and make sure that the battery life stays up on the iPhone. I think that's something that Apple is very concerned about. And to that end, the rumors are saying that the new iPhone would have better battery life, potentially a better camera. OmniVision announced that they have a new 8-megapixel sensor called the OV8830. It is actually the same dimensions as the sensor that's currently in the iPhone 4, the 5-megapixel sensor, so it could potentially just drop in. It does have the backlight illumination support, which means that it'll perform better in low light. OmniVision says it has a 35% improvement in low light performance for an 8-megapixel sensor. The thing is that being at the same size, the pixels are going to have to be smaller just to fit the form factor and fit more pixels in there. So it's still not going to be able to beat the low light performance that's in the current 5-megapixel sensor that's in the iPhone 4. And I have to say, that does a pretty good job. But, you know, some of my pictures, depending on the lighting, still come out a bit grainy. And I think the 5-megapixel pictures that the iPhone 4 takes are really good. And in a lot of the comparisons, when it's been held up against other phones that are out there on the market that are using, more megapixel sensors, like 8-megapixel sensors, the iPhone 4 actually beats them in overall image quality, I think. So it's going to be a hard sell to bump up the megapixels just to get more pixels in the phone. The one area where it might make a difference is that this new sensor from OmniVision does support 1080p video. So if Apple wants to get a phone on the market to compete with some of the other 1080p video phones that are coming out, they may have to bump up the sensor. I'm not so sold on this one yet, but it certainly is an option. And then the most far out rumor I've heard about the new iPhone 5 is that Apple is considering a version with a slide out keyboard. I'm going to say no way on that one. Apple's invested way too much in multi-touch and touch-based interfaces in iOS that I don't think they have any plans or believe in a physical keyboard on an iPhone at all. And if you look at the new, Palm Pre and some of the Palm phones that have been announced, those little tiny keyboards, I just don't think people really want to have those to type on, although it's certainly up for debate. A lot of people, I think I read a report recently that said typing on the iPhone is actually slower than on any other device, so we'll have to wait and see. And speaking of smaller things, the other thing that was rumored this week is that Apple may be considering a new smaller iPhone mini. This would be an iPhone that would be put out to compete with the other entry-level smartphones that are showing up on the market. The one weird thing about this is one of the rumors is saying that it would have either less storage or potentially no onboard storage, at least for media, that Apple would launch along with the iPhone mini pure cloud-based storage, something with Mobile Me. Mobile Me would become free. I think these reports were coming out of the Wall Street Journal, so it's a pretty good source. But You know, I think in order for that to happen, we would need to have unlimited data. The idea would be that all of your iTunes and all your movies and things that you purchased through iTunes would be stored up in the cloud, and then you would just stream that down to this little iPhone mini device if you wanted to watch that or consume it. But you can't do that on a 250 megabyte per month plan. It also brings up the question of what about apps? Where would apps be stored? The response to that was that there still would be a limited amount of onboard storage, probably something like 8 megabytes, like the new Apple TV 2, and you'd be able to store your applications in that area. But all of the data and everything else would kind of live out there in the cloud. Apple would certainly need to have a robust service to support that. We know they have the new data center out there in North Carolina, so that could be a possibility, but I think it's probably too much too soon. And I don't know that Apple wants to get into the entry-level smartphone market. You know, that's just not an area that Apple typically plays in, so there'd have to be a lot of good reasons for them to do that. But the rumor is out there for a new iPhone mini. Was also reported that Apple is spending about $7.8 billion with Samsung in 2011, becoming Samsung's largest customer. And I would assume that's so that they can lock up things like screens for iPhones and iPads, especially flash memory. All of Apple's flash memory, or a majority of Apple's flash memory, I believe, comes from Samsung. Also, Samsung makes the OEMs, the A4 processors for Apple. There have been mixed rumors about who might be making the next generation processors, those A5 processors for Apple. But if it is Samsung, I would imagine a big chunk of that $7.8 billion would go into that. Also, LCD displays for MacBooks and MacBook Pros. So Apple has a lot of reasons for spending that much cash with Samsung. And certainly, it's going to constrain supplies and help keep Apple's competitors, I think, at bay, because Samsung is a major supplier for components for a lot of Apple's competitors as well. And if you've noticed, those new tablet competitors that are coming on the market, not a single one of them offers a 64 gigabyte, or at least not one that I've seen yet. If you have seen one, let me know. But none of them offer 64 gigabytes of storage. The iPad seems to be the only device on the market that has that. And I have a feeling that's because flash memory supplies are really constrained. There's a lot of demand, and Apple's locked up a lot of the supply. So lots of rumors. A lot of things should be coming to light in the next few months. I would imagine we'll hear about the new iPad 2 very soon. Also, those new MacBook Pros. And then looking forward to the summer, what Apple is going to be doing with the new version of the iPhone 5. So stay tuned for all of that on upcoming episodes of the MacCast. Something that has been coming out is sort of how Apple has been doing with sales of that new Verizon iPhone here in the States. Boy Genius Report did some informal checks. They called up to, I think, like 5 Apple retail stores, asked about the most recent purchases, AT&T versus Verizon, about 1,500 sales from each store. And it looks like the Verizon iPhone is just slightly outselling the AT&T version in each of those retail stores by about 300 units per store. So not a huge uptick in Verizon sales, at least according to Boy Genius reports. Now, pre-orders were reportedly at about 550,000 units. That's not too shabby, but those aren't huge earth-shattering numbers. Certainly not the kinds of numbers that we heard about when Apple launched the iPhone 4 with AT&T last summer. In terms of how people are converting, again, keeping in mind it's a small sample size from Boy Genius reports, but they're saying that about 14% of the people are switching over to Verizon from AT&T. Certainly not the mass exodus I would have expected, but that is about half the customers. I think we remember hearing numbers about, you know, 30% switching over from Verizon to AT&T when the phone originally came out. So maybe they're getting about half their customers back. That's not too bad. And also, as far as people coming over from other devices, they're saying about 30% are switching over to the iPhone from Android and about 25% from BlackBerry. Verizon themselves, at least according to Bloomberg, said they are happy with the initial sales so far, but wouldn't give out any hard numbers. And if the impact on Verizon's network is any indication, Verizon is saying they're not having any problems at all handling the new traffic on the network. I'd be curious to hear your personal experiences. If you've picked up a Verizon iPhone, how are your data speeds going? How has the switchover been going? We talked a little bit on the last MacCast to Steve Stanger. He's been very happy with his new Verizon iPhone. And I think the consensus has been pretty good that people who are getting the iPhone on the Verizon network, certainly hearing a lot of really good things about the call quality, something that we still suffer from with our AT&T iPhones. You know, I've been kind of defending AT&T, at least in my area, although recently I have been seeming to get more drop calls. I don't know if it's just perception or awareness or something like that, but I did have a couple drop calls a couple weeks ago that I was pretty upset about. But I'm not planning on switching back anytime soon, if anybody's asking, because Verizon has not been typically, from a customer service perspective, a company that I've been very happy with. And I've been very happy with AT&T. They've been pretty good to me. And data transfer speeds is something that, you know, AT&T still, I think, has the edge. And I use my iPhone a little bit more for data than I do for voice. So I think it does come down to your usage pattern. If you're really heavily dependent on voice, Verizon might be the network for you. If you want the best performance in terms of 3G data coverage, I think AT&T still does have a little bit of the edge, assuming they have the coverage in the areas that you need to get to. So be interested to hear your feedback. Please send that along. But so far, things seem to be going pretty good for Verizon and the iPhone, even if maybe the sales aren't huge up front. I think long term we're gonna see how things shake out. But for now, there wasn't like they sold 2 million phones on the first day. It's looking like maybe something in the 600,000-700,000 unit range for the first couple weeks here. And we'll have to wait until Apple and Verizon release some official numbers, and I'm sure they will at some point. So stay tuned. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple released its 2011 Supplier Responsibility Report. And I bring this up because I think that Apple should be applauded for actually doing this report and actually putting it out and making it public. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But while I think Apple should be commended for actually doing the report, a lot of the stuff that's in there is, I think, a little bit depressing when we think about where our products come from. And you know that over the past year, one of Apple's suppliers, major suppliers, Foxconn, who does most of the iPhone, iPod Touch production, and I think iPad production and stuff like that, they had a whole rash of suicides that went on at their factory. A lot of reports came out that were very critical of Foxconn. And I think those reports and those things are important. I think we need to monitor and keep on top of these companies and suppliers. Apple is one of the few companies that's actually going in and auditing. As a matter of fact, according to the report, they upped the number of audits about 25% this year. And in their report, they use independent auditors. Those auditors were told by about 40% of the companies that Apple was one of the only companies that's ever come in and actually audited them. So that's a good thing. I mean, but the report points out things where they have found underage workers in factories. They've had found cases of chemical poisonings being in conditions that workers should not be in. There were cases of bribes that were tried to be paid to the auditors to not report these findings back to Apple. And in all of the cases, Apple lists out in this report what they found, what actions were taken, including terminating contracts with some suppliers who did not go back and fix these things. Apple went back in and re-audited factories. But I think the problem is that while Apple is at least doing this and making this information public and putting out this report, which is great, it's still not addressing the root of the problem. And that is that in these factories in China, the working conditions are really horrible and deplorable. And, you know, I don't know that much can be, it's frustrating, I guess, for me as a consumer, as someone who loves Apple products. I'm happy to see Apple taking some steps, and they're taking steps that I think are a lot more than a lot of their competitors are doing. But overall, I think we as consumers need to put more pressure on Apple and more pressure on the other electronics manufacturers to kind of go in and work to make these conditions better. But at the same time, they have to remain competitive, and all of these companies are doing businesses in places like China. So I don't like to get political. I don't like to try and, you know, push agendas. But I definitely think that we as consumers need to give feedback, and we need to say to Apple, yes, you're doing a great job, but you probably need to do more, or you definitely need to be doing more. And so if you can send email, you know, go to apple.com/feedback and say you're doing a great job, but we want to see conditions get better in these places. A great example that was pointed out in this report, and I think Leander Kahaney over at Cult of Mac noted, and when it came to the suicides, there's a whole section on the suicides at the Foxconn factory. And the resolution was that Foxconn put nets around their buildings to stop, you know, suicides that just happened kind of spontaneously. And then they also provided funding or provided counselors for workers. But that doesn't change the fact that the reason these workers need counseling or are depressed or we need to put nets on the outside of the factory is that the working conditions and the hours and the kinds of labor are making an impact on the workers. So those things need to change. The source of the problem is not being addressed. They are addressing the result. And we could do more to address the core issue that's going on. And so I would, you know, hope that we can go back to Apple and say, now, let's do more. Let's make this better. And I think Apple's the type of company that will lead the charge. And hopefully, if Apple leads the charge, then other manufacturers and other companies will follow suit. So at the very least, Apple does do this report. They put it out. They make it available. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And we should encourage these other companies to do at least what Apple is doing. And I think it's the bare minimum at this point. And I'm hoping this is the start of something and Apple's going to take it further. I think they actually will. Because I think knowing Steve Jobs and the type of person that he is when it comes to these world type issues, I think he does care about this stuff. I think change starts somewhere, and if we can start it with Apple, and if we as consumers can continue to push Apple and say, you're doing a good job, keep doing better, keep going, and keep working on this stuff, I think ultimately we can make a difference, and we can make some change. It might be slow in happening, it might not happen as fast as I would like or you would like, but at least we can kick off this process. So good job to Apple for putting this out, and let's keep things going. Now, keeping things going in the podcast here, I received a voicemail from Mike, and Mike had a question about the setup process for new iPads.
Hey Adam, this is Mike, and I'm just calling in to ask a pretty simple question, but I get it asked all the time, so I'm going to ask the expert. I really love your MacCast, by the way. Keep up the good work. But when you buy an iPad, iPhone, or iPod Touch, it asks you to sync it with a computer or a base station of a computer on iTunes. And I just wondered, especially for the iPad, why is that? Because it is a computer in its own self. It isn't, it's an iPad, it's a, you know, it's a touchpad computer and a very sophisticated one. And I just wondered why you have to do that. A lot of friends of mine have bought them, and they're, you know, they buy them and then they come to me and, well, how do you activate this thing? And I have to explain to them, because fortunately I went through the same experience with my iPad. So I just wondered what the story is on that, why that is, and why Apple, and even when you go buy it, they don't tell you that. They don't tell you anything. They just tell you how wonderful it is, but they don't tell you how to sync it with anything. At least that was what the experience I had with the Apple story. Appreciate the feedback on it if you can, and keep up the good work, and I really enjoy your MacCast. Thank you, sir. Bye.
Hey, Mike. A lot of people wonder about that, I think, because the iPad is kind of a computer in and of itself, and so why would you need to hook it to a computer? I think it's a little more obvious when you think about the iPod or even maybe the iPhone, because you're going to be syncing your music and stuff like that with it, and if you're buying stuff in iTunes, you're going to want to hook it to iTunes so that you can actually sync that stuff up. Some of that same philosophy goes for the iPad as well. I think from Apple's perspective, one of the reasons they'd like you to hook these devices to your Mac or PC and then connect them to iTunes is that they can get you having an iTunes account. And that iTunes account, as we're finding out, Apple is leveraging for the new subscription stuff I was talking about earlier. But it's sort of Apple's way to gain a base of people that can purchase things in the iTunes store. So I think we can't overlook that. I don't think it's something that Apple's trying to make a requirement. But it, you know, when you think about things like this, you think, well, maybe they actually are. Maybe this is all about signing up people for iTunes. I think the other part of it, though, is probably the more accurate one, and that is that there is no way to back up the data that is on the iPad without hooking it to a computer. We can't hook any kind of disk to it. We can't connect any kind of external storage. Now, one could probably argue that, well, it is a computer, and we should have the ability to do that. We should have the ability to, why can't we hook up a USB hard drive to, say, the camera connection kit and then run an app on the iPad to do the backup? And certainly you could do that. Or even better yet, why can't we just back it up directly to the cloud? And I think that Apple probably has plans for that at some point. I think a lot of the things we're hearing about, the rumors we're hearing about changes to Mobile Me possibly going free, and some of the cloud offerings that Apple is probably working on are going to come to light, and that's going to change sort of how iPads work and what we do with them. But for now, really, it's about syncing the device and also upgrading the software. That's another thing, is you can't put a newer version of the iOS on those devices without going through iTunes. Again, that's something Apple could enable over the air, and we're not really sure why they haven't done that yet. I will say that the experience that you're describing is very different than the experience that my in-laws had when they purchased their iPad. The people at the Apple store actually were very upfront with them about the need to connect it to a computer, and when my in-laws explained that they didn't have a Mac, that the iPad was going to be their primary device, they actually set it up and activated it for them in store. So they left with a fully functioning and activated iPad. Now they have the dilemma of, well, they're not going to be able to back it up, but they're not that concerned about it because they're using it mainly for surfing the web, getting email, which is on Gmail, and that's stored in the cloud anyway. So there's no need for having to worry about an extra backup in that case. But the other thing is that I explained to them before they went into the Apple store that they were going to need a computer. And the plan here is that when they come over, I'll set up a separate user account on one of my Macs. And when they're here visiting, we'll go ahead and back it up and I'll upgrade the software for them. So they might not have the most up-to-date software right when it's released, but eventually it is going to get updated. And that still is required. I'm really hoping that someday Apple will change that. But for now, those are the main reasons why. And hopefully that answers your question. All right. Thanks. Now, I have another question, and it's not often that I have one that really stumps me, but every once in a while, someone comes up with a scenario that is just something I've never come across, and even going out and kind of Googling doesn't return any results. And so I think this is one that we're going to have to crowdsource. We're going to have to throw out to the Mac community. But I received this voicemail from John, and he had this little bit of a dilemma with regard to music in iTunes.
Hey, Adam, this is John in North Carolina, and I have a iTunes question for you. I spent some time in China last year and picked up some Chinese music from various sources over there, and now that I'm back in America, I'm running my Mac in the English version again, and the songs that I imported into my iTunes, the titles and the artist name, which I prefer to be in Chinese, switches to text that I can't read. It just looks like, you know, like Weinding's font or something like that, which most people would probably say looks like Chinese, but it's actually not. If I switch my system back to a Chinese operating system or just go into the international under system preferences and change that, the titles go back to Chinese. I could go through and copy and paste the titles and the artist name for each of those songs individually, which would take me quite a while, and I've experimented with this, and it will stick if I copy from the Chinese system into the English system, but I'm wondering if there's a way to better do this. So if you can help, that would be great. I'd love to know why this is happening, because things that, you know, if I type it in myself, it doesn't change, and maybe you can address that for me. Thanks a lot, and enjoy the show, and keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks, John. You know, you got me on this one. I'm totally clueless as to what might be happening. I can kind of guess. My speculation is that potentially there is, and I don't know this much about the metadata that is in audio files that are purchased from iTunes, but I'm guessing that maybe one of two things is happening. There is metadata that is language specific. I don't even know if that's possible. So maybe there's Chinese metadata and then there's US or English metadata. And even though you're flipping over to the US operating system, it's loading that US metadata and it's just showing up in that font that you described. I'm not really familiar with that font. The other thing is maybe there's just something weird with the Unicode character sets. But I am pretty positive there's probably someone in the MacCast community, one of you who's listening right now, who probably knows what's going on with John's iTunes music. If you could send me along an audio comment or an email and let me know what you think it might be, John, I think we might be able to get a solution for you. So the power of the MacCast community is going to get on this one, and hopefully I'll have an answer for you by the next show. All right, so stay tuned. Thanks, John, for the question. All right, now I want to revisit a tip that I know we've covered on the MacCast before, a little trick in Spotlight. You know, there's a lot of power under the hood of Spotlight that goes beyond just doing your basic searches. One that I use every day is using it as an application launcher, just, you know, using the keyboard shortcut command plus the space bar to activate the little Spotlight search bar in the menu bar, and then typing the first few characters of the application I want to launch and hitting enter, because it comes up as the top hit. The other thing that a lot of people use is the calculator functions that are built right into Spotlight. You may or may not have been aware of that, but you can actually type formulas right into the Spotlight search bar. Again, just hit Command plus Spacebar to activate the search bar and type a formula. Now, you can type simple formulas like 2 plus 2 and you'll get the answer 4, or multiplication, but you can actually type some pretty complex mathematical formulas in there. And a couple cool things that you can do is once you have the result, if you just press Command C on the keyboard, you don't need to make any kind of selection. You just make sure the insertion point is still in the Spotlight search bar. Command C, it will actually copy the result, and you can paste that anywhere on the Mac. But the other thing is that it does support advanced math operators. So if you want to get, say, a number to the power of another number, so 2 to the power of 2 or 2 to the power of 3, you can just type 2. And then in Snow Leopard, it's a caret, the little character that's shift 6, the little caret, and then the power that you want to take that number to. In older versions of the operating system, I think you actually had to type POW, P-O-W, and then put the value you wanted to get the power of in parentheses. It was actually, you would put the first number and then comma and then the number that you wanted to take it to the power of. But complex things like pi, you can use the word pi, P-I, to calculate formulas based on the number, the value of pi. You can do cosines. You can do square root by typing SQRT and then in parentheses put the number that you want to get the square root of. And if you want to find out all of the mathematical formulas that are possible, you can use the manual pages that are built into the Unix operating system that underlies Mac OS X by using the terminal. So if you go into Applications Utilities, launch your terminal, and then at the terminal prompt, just type man, the word M-A-N for manual, space math, and hit enter, that will give you the math operators. And for those of you who have never used the terminal before, any command, you can use the manual command to get the description of what is available for that command in the terminal. And when you're in reading through the manual pages, the easiest way to navigate, there's a number of different ways, but I'll give you the easiest way. You tap the space bar and that will advance the screen one page worth of information. And then if you need to quit the manual or get out of the manual mode, just type the letter Q and that will exit the manual and put you back at the command prompt in the terminal. But type man math and that'll give you all of the possible things that you can put into the Spotlight search bar to do mathematical calculations. And it's pretty cool. Play around with it, and you'll be surprised at the kinds of formulas you can actually type right into Spotlight and get the answers from. So just a little tip there for you for today. And then one more item in this episode of the MacCast. It's going to run about 20 minutes or so. Last week, there was a story that came out about hackers being able to get at the password information that's stored in the keychain on iOS devices, and that they could do that if they gained physical access to your device, and even if you had the passcode lock set through using jailbreak techniques, they could get at some of your password files. And it caused quite a stir in the community. I wanted to drill down, get the details, find out how vulnerable we were. And so I invited a friend of the show, a security expert, and also just all-around good guy, George Starcher, back on the MacCast. You've probably heard him here before. You may have heard him on Victor Cahiao's show, The Typical Mac User, or over on Mac OS Ken. He wears a lot of hats. But I invited him in to talk about this iPhone password hacking and find out, you know, how vulnerable are we and what do we need to do to protect ourselves. So here's my interview with George.
Hey, George.
Hey, Adam.
How's it going?
Oh, just getting all packed up to go on travel for a week for work.
Cool. Well, I wanted to get you on the MacCast. There was a story this week. I kind of told the listeners about it, you know, that the iPhone has been hacked, right? And the hackers can now get in and they can get to your passwords. I think this came out of a German security site. Fraunhofer? Is that
what you said? Yeah, Fraunhofer Institute for Secure Information Technology.
And it got picked up by all the Mac blogs, as happens with these stories, and you know, gets I think pumped up a little bit more than maybe it should. You know, I pay attention to these things, and I think the listeners should too, because we want to be informed and know about what's going on, right? I mean, it's important that we get this kind of information. But the flip side of that is that the internets, you know, tend to pump these things up, and it's hard to get at the real details. So I wanted to get you on because I know you're more versed in security issues than I am, and I like to go to trusted sources, and you're one of those.
Thank you.
And so what I want to just ask you is, I mean, you read the story. They're saying this is a big deal because someone can get in, they can jailbreak your phone. Even if you have the passcode lock, they can get in there, they can get access to your keychain file. And then your keychain file has passwords and other information that I guess in some cases there's stuff in there that isn't encrypted. Is that what the concern is?
And I gave you the link so you can actually put it into the show notes. You know, everyone's probably seen the link to the video, but reading the actual paper is a bit more informative.
This is the white paper from Fraunhofer. Fraunhofer,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, from the guys themselves, right?
I will link to that. It's a PDF, and I'll link to that in the show notes for sure.
So pulled up on your iPad, right? In essence, based on in the key thing, if you read nothing else in this document, you go to page 7, and you go to this table 1, and it says test results regarding availability of secrets being the passwords, to attackers in the lost device scenario. So again, someone has to actually get your device. They have to get physical ownership. And in security, the general rule is if they want you bad enough and they physically have whatever it is you have your stuff in, they're eventually going to get in. Physical ownership, you know, is still, you know, 9/10 of the law. Well, in security terms, it's everything.
Right.
They'll eventually get in if they are so determined to do so. But in this case, they have to get your device in order to jailbreak it. And then once they've jailbroken it, then they can get into the keychain file. And there's certain aspects and data that's in the keychain file that, according to their research, is accessible without the passcode. Now, it doesn't mean it's not encrypted, but it does mean that you have to call through certain APIs of the phone in order to, it basically decrypts and hands it to you in an unencrypted format. So effectively it's unencrypted, but it's there because if you look at this table, mm-hmm. you'll see the things that say accessibility without passcode are things like generic IMAP account, CalDAV, emails, you know, Google Mail set up as an MX Exchange account, meaning it's set up as ActiveSync, like if you're a Google Apps user or something like that. Your Wi-Fi passwords, Because if you think about it, these are things that your phone is able to do while it's locked, but you're still moving around. So if I come home in my car, my display's locked, it'll still jump onto my Wi-Fi and then download my mail. Because it needs to get to the Wi-Fi passcode, obviously, in order to join my Wi-Fi network automatically, in order to automatically check my mail or to pull down push notifications from Apple. It needs to get to certain credentials to make those things happen, right? And if I'm looking at this table as a pattern, those are the things I'm seeing that are accessible without passcode. Not absolutely everything, just those things. So like if you use Yahoo, like specifically they mentioned Yahoo email, AOL email, and Google Mail, and those are listed as protected. To me, probably what those are, especially if you look at Yahoo Mail, it says token plus cookie right. Is the type of secret. That's telling me, excuse me, that probably what they're talking about are where you went into Safari and went to those sites. Like, you know, mail.yahoo.com through Safari, and then you logged in, and it gives you, basically a web app.
Right.
Optimized for the iPhone experience. It feels like it's built into the app and built into the phone, but it's not really. And those things are protected because it's key to remember the iPhone 4 particularly, and it's really kind of starting with the 3GS, but certainly iPhone 4 and forward, there is the ability to encrypt all the data in the device. The problem is, the vendors, the software developers, have to implement it, right? And if they don't, then that data could be, you know, once they jailbreak the device and can get to the storage of the device, they could pull out any data that's in that app, or in this case, you know, part of what's available in the keychain.
Right. Yeah, so there's a couple of key things I want to point out and just have you explain to listeners. First would probably be you know, the concept of a keychain, if people don't know what that is, we should probably explain the keychain, which is what?
It, you know, just like, you know, your physical keychain, right? It's your password to all these services. And particularly if you want the device to be able to automatically go to these services, it has to know who you are. So it has to save your username, your password, you know, to your VPN, to your email accounts, to your Google Talk, you know, to your iChat, whatever, and in order to, automatically access those services for you on your behalf.
Right.
And so it has to store those things somewhere. So having a keychain is an organized location to keep such sensitive credentials.
Right. So this is the sort of thing, you know, on your Mac, you have a keychain, and when you're using Safari and asks if you want to save a password to your keychain, or you're using an application that says, do you want to save this password to your keychain? It puts it in there, and the keychain is locked by your user account password, right? So
typically, yes, you can actually change that on a Mac and make your keychain password different from your user password. Because there's ways to crack the user password because, you know, basically it's based on Unix. So the tools that work for that can work for that. But then you can run into some really bad user experience issues
right.
Where it wants to go into the keychain, but the passwords don't match up. So it doesn't just happen automatically. So, but again, that's where everything's kept.
Yeah, but the concept I want to point out here is, though, you know, this is a little bit, I think this is a little bit different. And correct me if my understanding's wrong, but this is a little bit different than on the Mac, because on the Mac, if I have stored stuff into my keychain and then I log out of my user account, right?
Right.
That keychain, everything in there is locked down.
Correct.
And you can't get at it unless you have that one login password, and then that unlocks the keychain, and then applications have access to that. So if I'm using my Mac and it's running and I'm logged into my user account and I walk away, somebody's going to have access, you know, with physical access to my machine is going to have access to my passwords.
And the fundamental nature of the phone is it's always running. It's always, you know, checking for phone calls. It's checking for SMS messages. In the case of it being a nice smart iPhone, it maybe is checking your mail, looking for that push mail from MobileMe. It's looking for that push mail from Google. It's jumping onto your Wi-Fi automatically when you get home instead of using up all your data on your 3G. And with the passcode locked, it still, as a device, needs access to those credentials.
Right.
And I think that's, in essence, what they're doing is they're bypassing the code lock and then tricking the phone into thinking that you have properly unlocked it. Therefore, then lets those credentials be pulled.
Right. And that's what I wanted to sort of explain to people is the somewhat the difference. So you think you're kind of logged out when your phone is asleep and the passcode locks on, but there's still, as you're mentioning, there's certain services that are still running in the background that the phone still needs access to. So it still has that kind of access. And in the case of this particular exploit, they've gained physical access to the phone. They jailbreak it, and then they sort of trick it into running like this.
Yeah. In other words, they're gaining access to the things that the phone itself automatically has access to while it's locked.
Okay.
Right.
So then the last two things that I want to talk about is, well, okay. One, first and foremost, your biggest problem with this exploit is that you've lost your phone. Either it got stolen, you left it somewhere. Somebody who's not you has gained physical access to the device.
Right. So you end up into a race condition. Now, you may have, if you have Mobile Me, you can do the whole, you know, find my iPhone and then kick a wipe off. But obviously, if they're determined to get you and they're intentionally going after your data, they could easily just, you know, turn the device off or most likely yank the SIM card out.
Right.
And then suddenly it no longer has cellular access. And therefore, it will never get the command, assuming it doesn't walk by a Wi-Fi hotspot.
Open Wi-Fi, yeah.
Yeah, that it can jump onto. And then it can no longer receive that command. And actually bags that forensics people use to put phones in, like if cops are going to, you know, say it's a drug dealer, right, to get his phone, they actually have Faraday bags, you know, bags that are designed to prevent any signals from going in and out. And they'll drop the phone in the bag.
Right.
And seal it. And right. That way it can't actually get to the cellular or wireless networks anymore. That way the guy cannot remotely wipe the device while it's in custody.
But, you know, let's talk real world scenarios here, right? In most cases, people are going to maybe leave their phone somewhere, it gets lost. You know, Apple has made Mobile Me, the Find My iPhone thing, free. So people mm-hmm. should probably just sign up for that. I mean, there's no reason not to have that now, right?
Absolutely not. I would definitely do it. And then just as soon as you know you've lost the device, go look and see where it is. And if it's not in a place that you're comfortable that you can get it back from quickly, then you need to make the decision on your own about the value of information.
Right.
And whether you want to send it a wipe.
Right. And the one thing about sending a wipe that people should be aware of is once you've wiped it, you can't track it anymore, I don't think.
That's correct. It resets at the factory like it came out of the box. And, you know,
so that's a little bit of a catch 22.
You file your insurance claim and get a new one.
Yeah. So, yeah, you have to make a judgment call at that point. But, you know, the other thing is just the information. You're right. You have to think about the information that's on it and also the types of information that you're putting on it. Right?
Yes.
I mean, people should be aware and how you're storing that. You know, there's services like 1Password, and that was the other part of this that I think you pointed out and we should be very clear about, is that encryption is there and available to developers, but they have to choose to
use it.
And you don't really have any way of knowing who's using encryption or who's not.
Yeah, unless you can contact that vendor and get them to admit. I mean, obviously the 1Password guys, we both know them. We know they're real diligent. I use that app. I have full faith and confidence that, you know,
yes.
If someone jailbreaks my phone, they're not getting into my 1Password storage, right? But they might get into my, and again, I'm just going to throw out I'm not going to name it, but let's say you have one of these apps that lets you dump files onto your phone while the app is running through like a web interface or something.
Right. Yeah. One of these web dev. Yeah, turn on a web dev server and I can
Or one of these
files.
Apps that lets you download PDFs and view them and things.
Yep.
You don't know whether those have implemented encryption. So even if you put a lock code to keep someone from getting in it, it doesn't necessarily mean the contents are encrypted. Therefore, someone jailbreaks the phone, they might be able to go into that area, the disk, you know, the phone's memory where that's stored, and then, you know, extract out that stuff.
Right.
It's possible.
Right.
Likely, not necessarily, but possible, yes.
Okay. Last thing I want to ask you about, because this came out, you know, and it was sort of pointing the finger at the iPhone as being insecure. I mean, is this isn't just an iPhone problem, right? This is a mobile devices as we get tablets and iPads and iPhones and smartphones.
They all have similar issues. The most secure device is a BlackBerry. I mean, I'll tell you straight up, if a BlackBerry is properly locked with the content encryption on with a passcode, it's a running joke at least once a month on a forensics mail list I'm on that some newer person will say, hey, I've got a case with a BlackBerry and it's locked. We all just laugh at them because you're not getting in it, right? You're going to wipe the device before that happens. You just hope that you're dealing with a company that's got IT that manages the device, and then they can force it to be unlocked. But an iPhone, basically any of the ones that you hear can be rooted or jailbroken, you can assume your stuff is not safe in that device 100%. And particularly in my experience, at least the iPhone supports encryption. If it's properly implemented, that's not true on Android. On Android, pretty much hang it up, it's not encrypted.
It's a little more, open.
Yeah, someone gets it, it's game over. They've got it. Now, there are a few apps, like where I previously worked, we used an app called Touchdown that talked to our mail server, and we only let the company mail go through that app because it supported the encryption, you know, forced encryption from ActiveSync, you know, through Microsoft and stuff for a company standpoint. So, but it made for a bad user experience, but it's just what we had to do if they wanted an Android.
Right.
Because then the mail for the company and the contacts for their company all existed within this one app rather than natively in the phone, which does make for a rougher user experience. I would love nothing more than if Google got off their butt, quit rushing stuff to market, quit rushing it out as a consumer product, and actually turned on full encryption and supported it properly. You know, that would be great, but they don't.
Let me ask you one final thing, and then I'll let you go, because I'm getting more and more the sense that people need to personally just take responsibility for their data and their security and should almost never rely on a vendor or a manufacturer or some third party to take care of that stuff, right? I mean, this is sort of what it comes down to. If you don't want your credit card, you know, stolen, then don't be storing it in your phone.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, you gotta, they do have some responsibility to make good products.
Sure.
Right? And,
sure.
And to be worth the money we're putting on them, especially if they hype it as being secure and ready for, you know, business use and all that. I think they do have a certain level of responsibility. But just as with anything, you have to take responsibility for your stuff and make your own risk-based decision about what you put in it. You know, don't email your credit card number knowing that email's not secure. But maybe 1Password, you know, honestly, I might have some of that type of information in my 1Password file.
Right,
but I have much more confidence in how strong their password is, or their protections are, even based, you know, against something else I might do it. Because at some point you're gonna have to use these devices. I mean, you know, it's like from an IT standpoint, if you're trying to keep these out of your enterprise and out of your business, you're in front of the steamroller. You know, it's gonna run you over eventually. What you got to do as an IT person or even as a user is do it responsibly. You know, use the lock codes and stuff. Yes, that in this case, it may be partially bypassable by jailbreaking and getting access to some of the other credentials. But, you know, take the responsibility to know that it's at least a risk. And if you lose the phone, react. Wipe it. Change your passwords, you know, for things like your mail accounts and stuff that you had in it and get it done. Just like if you lose your credit cards or it gets stolen, you don't wait. You call the credit card company right then and notify them that it's gone, so that if our charges do turn up, you're not responsible for them.
Right. So I guess it's on both sides of the coin. I don't know. The more and more I see stories like this, I just think that, you know, we need to be a little more aware, and that's why I wanted to get you on here and sort of demystify the hype and get kind of down to the nitty gritty and let people know what they need to do.
I do want to add one little extra comment to that is don't just make that decision for your data. If we all have jobs, and if your company has a policy against personal devices, don't put the company data on it. Because I'm telling you, in a previous life, I have seen people lose their jobs because they associated their personal devices with the company account, and they were caught, and company data had been sent to that device and likely compromised because, you know, IT might, if you have a company issued iPhone, they might be making sure that your iPhone stays up to date on the firmware, right? But if it's a personal device, the company has no way to know that you will or will not be responsible and keep that done. And therefore, you're, you know, incurring a risk. So treat all data like it's your own. Don't just do something wholeheartedly, you know, with your business data, no matter how badly you want it, without at least talking to them. Maybe there's a compromise. Maybe there's a waiver, as long as you know you let them turn on all the security settings. Check with your people before you do it. And honestly, the last thing too, if I'm going to make a choice, if you really need to be secure, honestly, as much as I hate to say it, a BlackBerry. Your second choice, an iPhone. Last choice, an Android. Because the other thing about the Androids are, at least if there's an update for an iPhone, we plug it into iTunes, we can update, right? But how many droids do you know that can be updated to the latest version of Android? They can't. You know, unless you root it, aka jailbreak it, and get some copy of firmware from God knows, you know, ownme.com, right? And hope that they're honest guys.
Right.
That's a legitimate firmware and hasn't been backdoored. You can't get the latest thing on your phone unless the provider, the carrier that made your phone, you know, updates their stuff. That's the danger with Android, is it's beginning to get much more and more fragmented from a patch level standpoint. So things that are headlines today about the iPhone may be gone in a month when they come out with the next update. But things that were headlines for an Android last year are still heavily in play because nobody can update their bloody phone.
Yep. Good advice. Good advice. Well, thank you, George, again for coming on and helping us with some of these security issues. You know, I know you wear some other hats. A lot of times people can find you over on the Typical Mac User podcast doing this sort of stuff. So they should check you out there for sure. Right.
Yep. Yep.
And then also you are the call screener for Mac OS Ken's live show. When is that show?
It is Wednesday nights. Now, actually, I won't be there this Wednesday because I got to be out of town for work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'll be back the following Wednesday. But yeah, every Wednesday night, if you just follow, you know, Ken Ray, you can also check Mac OS Ken for the information. You can also just go to Ustream and search for, you know, Mac OS Ken live. And if you don't want to listen to it live, you can always listen to it in iTunes. Just search for Mac OS Ken. And it's the one with the album art that's got him in a hat.
Yep.
That's the live show there.
Great, great podcast. And be sure to check out the video stuff you've done for Victor on Typical Mac User too, because there's some great stuff on VPN. We've talked a little bit about it, but you go into much more detail, and I learned a lot from that stuff. So you should check it out. Any other place people should keep up with you? What's your Twitter?
Just George Starcher. You can find me there at Twitter at that. You can find georgestarcher.com.net. You know, just my full name, George Starcher. You can find me anywhere.
Cool. Thanks, George.
Thanks.
There you go. George Starcher, very smart guy when it comes to security. Good to have him as a friend who can come on and demystify this stuff for us. So I want to thank him again for being on. Be sure to catch him on Victor's show, typicalmacuser.com, or over on Mac OS Ken Live. And I'm sure we'll have him back on the show again. But I think that's going to do it for us for today. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software and get demos and more information over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, all great apps. I use every single one of them. You can get details and trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. Great way to protect and lock down your Macs, especially if they're in a shared computing environment. You can get more information and details as well as trials over at Phoronix.com. And a big, huge thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. If you have anything for me, any questions, comments, feedback, especially if you have those answers to the Chinese language iTunes question, I'd love to hear from you. You can send your email to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave a voicemail message there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you do it there, you'll save on long distance charges. So that's great for our international listeners. And if you do leave a voicemail, if you could leave your email address and spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. Sometimes I have follow-up questions, things like that, and it's good to be able to get a hold of you. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, including that white paper on the iPhone security, you'll find that at the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. And I should also mention that if you want to get more MacCast, you can sign up to become a MacCast member. It's a great way to support the show, and you get additional content each and every week. I try and put together tips and tricks and extra stuff, extra interviews you'll hear over there that you won't hear on the ad-supported show. And it's all through the generous support of members like you. So if you'd like to find out more details about that program, you can head to member.maccast.com. There's a bunch of different options for signing up. You can go month to month. You can go 6 months or a year. Whatever you like, whatever fits your schedule, your budget, what have you. And on this last episode, I gave a little tip on I had a need to play Pandora, or I wanted to play Pandora Radio, I guess I should say, in the background on my Mac. And I run through a couple different ways that you can actually do that without having to have the website up and running in Safari. So if you'd like to check that out, along with 68 other great episodes we've done so far, you can find that at member.maccast.com. But if not, continue to tune in to the MacCast each and every week. You can also find me between shows on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to be it for this one. Thanks for hanging out and listening once again. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.